Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I am married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself?
You know, one of the things about Russell is that he suffers from the desire to get what he wants until he has it, and then he no longer wants it. And that is a common malady for somebody with sex addiction. Believe it or not, if you love somebody who is a sex addict, sometimes it's not about the sex. It's about the pursuit. The pursuit and the seduction. And when there is pursuit and seduction, that is the intrigue. That is the high. That is the fix. And for Russell, that's his MO. He's always looking for the next best thing. And once he finds it, he finds that it's not good enough. Hi, I'm Carol Jurgensen-Sheets, and this is Sex Help with Carol the Coach. This is the only show on iTunes that deals week after week after week with sexual addiction. And I am so glad to be with you. You know, we definitely work with experts in the field that address lots of different situations. For instance, last week we talked to Dr. Ken Adams. He talked about enmeshment with men who were too close to their mothers. And he also talked about a couple's intensive program that he's starting at the Meadows. Three different segments that make up a series. And, you know, he really feels like this is one way to get to the bottom line of the trauma that both people have experienced. I, as a certified sexual addictions therapist, really believe that there are lots of different ways to heal. It might be individual therapy. It might be an intensive. It might be residential treatment. It might be a variety. It might be group. You've heard me say it before. There are lots of different recovery tools, but the more recovery tools you use, the more likely you are to heal. Now, I've got this buddy. His name is Bill Herring, and Bill is going to be on the show in a couple of months, but he wrote an article called Chronic Sexual Deception. And he says, you know, there are many causes and solutions, and he not only talks about why do people cheat, but he talks about oftentimes the fact that these folks that cheat don't fully consider the consequences. As a matter of fact, they're really talking about their feeling, and they're only about themselves. He says that studies show that about 4% of the population doesn't operate with a strong moral code. Although that doesn't sound like a high percentage, one out of every 25 people will do what they want if they can get away with it. And that's not a statistic to take lightly. And he says, you know, with addiction, with sexual addiction, it's more than just the occasional infidelity. Sexual addiction is about repeated, ongoing acts of infidelity that cause all sorts of trauma in relationships and one's self-esteem. He says, since secretive sexual behavior can be both a cause and effect of narcissism, it can sometimes be difficult to determine which came first. In other words, are addicts narcissistic, or does sexual addiction cause narcissism? Now, I'm not a believer that that term should be used lightly. Most people will come in and they'll go, my husband or my wife is narcissistic. Well, they may have some features, but true narcissism is a disorder that is very difficult to deal with. And people that live with a narcissist are typically worn down and acquiesce to everything they do. Infidelity is a very, very selfish behavior. I mean, let's face it. When you got married, you said to yourself, this is my vow. My vow is to be with you through sickness and in health. And so sexual secret keeping is part of that infidelity, and at times is an acting out of an earlier painful experience in life. And boy, I don't know about you, but if you have sexual addiction, I want you to really look at your childhood. What may be at the root of that acting out? And know that there is help. You can go to a certified sexual addictions therapist. You can get yourself into an intensive program. You know, get on the website. Look and see what feels right. Look for experts in the field that have written books, that have proved to you that their mission is to help with sexual addiction and infidelity. Send me an email at carolthecoach@AOL.com. And I'll tell you who the experts are in the field so that you're not spending your money foolishly. Again, you can email me at carolthecoach@AOL.com, or you can go to my website, Sex Help with Carol the Coach, and look and see what resources that I recommend. Who do I really like in the field? Who do I trust to do a good job with my clients? Because if I get a client who's not been happy with previous service, you better believe I'm not going to refer again. Or if I didn't make the initial referral, I'm not going to refer at all. And my job is to work with every kind of population. Male sex addicts, female sex addicts, partners. You know I'm getting my certification in partners of trauma and sexual addiction, so that I can be very helpful there. You know, I work with the gay and lesbian community. I work with transgendered folks. I work with families where sexual addiction has occurred. I work with the kids. I work with the adult kids. Not everybody feels comfortable working with all those populations, but truly it is very important to find somebody who does. Now, tonight, we're going to be talking to Jeffrey Zacharias, who's an expert in treating people who have sex, trauma, and addiction in their lives. And he specifically works with the lesbian and gay and transgendered community. He's the clinical director of New Hope Recovery Center, and he believes that treatment for the community requires a specialized approach. So we're going to be talking to him and finding out, what is the same and what is different about working in this community? And truly, a lot of the men and women that I have worked with that have been traumatized in their childhood have acted out sexually so that they feel some sense of control. And Jeffrey works with not only the lesbian and gay community, but he also works with addiction. So he is a specialist. He is a CSAT. He is an addictions therapist, and he's a licensed clinical social worker. So his theoretical background draws on psychodynamic therapy, and it is strength-based and solution-focused. So I hope you'll stay tuned and listen to him as he talks about CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. You've heard me talk about that before. It's a way to look at life differently and think about it differently and therefore relate to life differently. And he also uses mindfulness as well as DBT, dialectical behavioral therapy. So he's got a variety of tools that he really believes in, and I know he's going to be fascinating. Now, you know, I had a couple of questions this week about disclosure because I talked about that a few weeks ago. And interestingly enough, there's two D words, and I'm not talking divorce here. There are two D words that occur when there's sexual addiction. And the first is discovery, and that's when you find out that your partner has been cheating on you. And with discovery, it may be bits and pieces of that person's behavior. And so there is something called the disclosure. And the disclosure is when a partner, a sex addict, decides to share with his or her spouse everything that has ever occurred sexually. He will talk about his acting out. He won't go into details, but he'll talk about all the acting out that he participated in, and to the best of his ability, when did it occur, and how did it occur, and who did it occur with. And it helps the partner to feel like they've gotten that total picture of the infidelity in their life. And I really believe in doing that process with somebody who's trained. So I sit with a client and his or her spouse for about 3 hours as they share that history, and then the spouse is given the opportunity to ask any questions possible. And I follow it up with a polygraph test within 24 hours after the disclosure so that the spouse can be assured that the information was accurate, that everything that the addict experienced was true, that there is no more information that the addict consciously has an awareness of, and it helps to put to rest some of the fears that occurs. And I really believe in this process. It is a way to cleanse and heal and begin a new life. And so there are people in the country who do a really good intensive job of working with clients. You know, they provide 1, 2, or 3 day intensives for this process. And if you are feeling like this would help your relationship, I want you to give me a call or send me an email, carolthecoach@AOL.com, and I'll refer you to some of the best people in your area. You know, right now I send a lot of my clients to Houston because there's a very good intensive program there with Dr. Milt Magnus. I provide that service too, but sometimes I think 3 hours isn't enough. People need to get prepared. They need to work towards this process, and an intensive allows them to do that. So I highly recommend that you consider that so that the information doesn't eke out for days or weeks or months or years thereafter. That is what partners complain about the worst. They wonder what else they're going to find out and how are they going to be wounded by that information, and they'd rather just have it all up front. Makes sense, doesn't it? Very painful, very hard for the addict to deliver that information. He or she does not want to see their spouse really hurt. They don't want to give details that they know are going to crush their spouse. And at the same time, part of that recovery period and process is being 100% honest. And it's also shedding that dishonesty so that they can rebuild to a new life. And so I highly recommend that process. I can't say enough for how important it is to come clean. And when somebody comes clean, they're able to start a new life. And they have integrity. They think, good, I've said it all. I've done it all, and that's what counts. And again, it is an amazing process if you've got somebody who's skilled with making it happen. Unfortunately, I've had too many clients that thought they could do their own disclosure process. And they didn't have the safety and the support and the they didn't have the process in place to really help them through that whole experience, you know, because there needs to be a lot of self-care for both individuals when they do it. So I cannot highly recommend it enough when it comes to doing this valuable work that will start life over again. It is just an amazing process. And a very difficult one. You know, I work with clients probably for 4 to 6 weeks prior to the disclosure on both sides to get the right information out there, to go over their information, to have them write it out. Then I get questions from the partner to make sure that they've addressed everything. And then invariably, the client's spouse will have questions as he or she hears that information. They actually take notes so that they can write things out the way they need to. It sounds scary, doesn't it? Absolutely. But I promise, for those of you that have just found out that your spouse may be an addict, it is exactly what they need to do to reset the relationship and begin to develop trust. As difficult as it may be, it really makes a difference. And that's what this is all about, making a difference and starting over. And, you know, you've heard me say it before. My couples who deal with infidelity as opposed to sexual addiction, a lot of times they don't tolerate it, they don't put up with it, and they get separated and divorced. But my couples who are experiencing sexual addiction, it's almost like there's this understanding that this was compulsive behavior that the person couldn't stop. And so what has transpired as a result is that very clearly, you know, what needs to happen is there needs to be a default. There needs to be a process by which people can start over and begin to build that trust, because sexual addiction is an intimacy disorder. There is no doubt about it. And that is part of the problem. It's like, which came first, the intimacy disorder, or did the sexual addiction cause the intimacy disorder? Well, more often than not, people that get caught up in sexual addiction, unless it started with pornography, unless it started during the marriage and the pornography turned into chat rooms and the chat rooms turned into escorts or prostitutes or cheaters, usually it started way before the marriage. But there are occasions when porn has turned into other things. And that's why it's so important to look at your childhood, to look at your life, and decide, what is it that I need to do to make my life different? And I just can't stress it enough that couples need guidance. This is not something that they can typically work on by themselves. You know, tonight I was working with a man who was having real trouble reestablishing trust with his wife, She's so angry that to interrogate him, to find out more information, she feels like there's holes in his story. And he has given her all the information to the best of his ability. So he's getting frustrated. And what I said to him was, you have to understand that for the next month, 3 months, 6 months, year, even up to 2 years, you're going to be going the extra mile with her to build up that trust. And that's just part of the process of building the relationship. And that's so important to do. So I'm really excited because we're going to be talking about relationship building in the LGBT community tonight. I do have Jeffrey Sakarias on, and he's going to be talking about sex trauma and addiction in that community. So, Jeffrey, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Well, I am fine, and I'm really excited because clearly we do have a large lesbian and gay, bisexual, and transgender community that listens. And so, you know, I know that you have a real specialty in this area, in part due to newhoperecovery.com and certainly the center. So tell us a little bit about you, first of all.
Okay. Well, I've been in the social work field for about 13 years now, and over the course of the work that I've done, I you know, my area of practice is really focused on the LGBTQQI community and looking at addiction, whether it's a process addiction or a substance addiction or alcohol, and then trauma and mental health issues and what recovery could look like. And I do that at New Hope Recovery Center, which is an agency that I own. I purchased it from an existing owner about 4 years ago, and we really turned it kind of on its head and have more of a focus on those special populations. And, you know, we do partial hospitalization, we do intensive outpatient, we do regular outpatient, aftercare, regular, you know, therapy. We have HIV partner support groups, HIV support groups, men's multiple addiction groups. We have CMA and NA and Smart Recovery. And, you know, so we try to offer really a vast array of services to support the community in whatever way, you know, they want to be supported. So, and then I have a private practice that I maintain outside of that. And really, 99% of my work is LGBT-focused addiction, mental health, the same thing. But I get to work, you know, in a real different way, one-on-one as opposed to groups. So I love what I do. It's not even like working. It's just something, you know, I just love it. And so it's really exciting for me to be here and to be able to spread the word about the community and things to look for and talk about, and so I'm really excited about this.
Well, I would think so, and so obviously you made it your mission to work with that community.
Yeah.
And do you think that the addiction, the sex addiction, the trauma is different in a lesbian and gay, transgendered, bisexual community than amongst heterosexuals?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think really every single person that, you know, is on the planet really is, has some form of trauma going on in their lives. And it really is, you know, some of it is what they might call the big T traumas, which are those one-time singular events, whether it's, you know, the death of a parent or a car crash or, you know, coming back from war. And, you know, that contrast that with what's known as little T trauma. And those are ones that are a little more insidious every day. People might not traditionally think of them as traumatic. I don't know that one is any more or less traumatic than the others. I think they just present themselves in different ways. And, you know, there's just so much trauma for lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans individuals. It starts really early. And one of the areas that I work a lot in is language as one of those initial traumas. And something that disrupts the attachment that the LGBT community feels with their caregivers. And, you know, it's often starts as early as someone perceived that they might be gay, or someone knows that they might be gay. And even just in perhaps language or withdrawing of affection or keeping attachment away from the child, it starts very early on, and then you just kind of builds from there. And what we know about trauma, let's say in my age bracket, I'm almost 50, was, you know, when I was going to high school, the trauma was occurring when you went to high school. So, you know, I lived in the country and not much really happened in my home. But when I went to school, people were able to pick up on the fact that I was gay, although I was not out. It was a perception thing. And so, you know, the bullying was sometimes reserved for when I went to school and Monday through Friday. But now individuals, the bullying is 24/7, 365, and there's just not that opportunity to take a break from it. And then if it's, you know, in their home or over social media or language that politicians use, or, you know, things that are said on TV or in music, it just, many of our LGBT clients have never had the opportunity to get away from it. So, you know, it becomes even more profound because it's just kind of an ongoing onslaught, if you will, of things being said. So, you know, it just has taken different forms, and different generations see it differently. But it's still there. It's still going on. And so, you know, hopefully with the work that you're doing and the work that we've got going on in here in Chicago, we're going to be able to help at least reduce the harm of the bullying that's been there and find ways to heal, whatever that might be. So,
well, and you know, you were talking about little T trauma versus big T trauma, and a big T trauma may be something like a hurricane or a car accident. Or, but truly, when a gay or lesbian person has been bullied and made to fear for their life and felt less than over and over and over again, that little T trauma can turn into a big T trauma.
Absolutely, for certain. And it just morphs, and, you know, it could end up resulting in some trauma reenactment or blocking of trauma, or just taking another form by getting involved in relationships that really kind of recreate the original egregious acts. It just can, I don't know, it's just so interesting to me the way it comes out. And it can be, you know, we know that the rates of physical violence that happen, the rates of, you know, for instance, the trans community, the trans women of color have some of the highest murder rates in the country. And it's just, you know, people operating out of fear. And so just even anybody reading that on Facebook or seeing in the news, it's, again, it picks at that again and again. And now, you know, this, of course, political season has turned somewhat nasty, and, you know, there's things that are said there, and it just, you know, it just is hard sometimes for people to get a break, to get away from it. And then you begin to see where, you know, maybe the appeal of substances or alcohol or behaviors become so appealing because you get this chance to disconnect from the world and not hear that stuff. But of course, we know that, you know, once the disease sort of takes hold, it just is a progressive and chronic kind of thing as well. So, you know, I don't know. It's really scary, and it's everything from the thing that I find most interesting in working with clients is even the language of attachment or of safety. And, you know, it can be everything from, you know, somebody even just flippantly saying, oh, that's so gay. You know, kids used to say, oh, that's so gay. Well, what does that even mean? Or just downright awful things that have been said, and parents saying, oh, you're going to go to hell if you're gay. And, you know, I don't know. It just is, there's so much that goes into the trauma with the community. I don't know if it's any more or any less than any other community, but I think it presents itself in maybe harsher ways at times. So,
well, Well, absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting because, of course, we work with the skewed population anyway. They probably come in with anxiety or depression, and they probably come in with not feeling good enough. But truly, when you talk to the general public, be he or she gay, be he or she your neighbor, be your brother, your sister, whatever, there is a little bit of that I don't feel good enough that pops up in lots of different situations. And so, obviously, when we're in a society that judges gay, lesbian, trans people as being less than, and they grow up with that their entire life, they really have to do a lot of positive self-talk and find
they
a lot
do.
Of support to compensate for that.
Yeah. You know, one of the nice things, I guess, you know, well, for instance, I grew up in Kentucky. And where I grew up in was very rural and not accepting at all of anyone of any kind of difference outside of sort of the white heterosexual, you know, not stereotype, that's not the right word, but the sort of white straight as the way to be. And so, you know, having not only a lot of friends, but really struggling to come to terms with who I was, you know, you're already kind of a little behind the eight ball before you even get going to figure out who you are. And it's really no wonder that people take the various routes to destructive behavior they do. Now, if you grew up in a big city, like I live in Chicago now, and I'm on the north side of Chicago, which is, you know, fairly well affirming. And, you know, you really don't think twice about it living here. Some of the traumas that are experienced could depend on parts of the country and, you know, are you safe in where you live? And then if you, you know, moving here to Chicago, there's so many more things to get yourself into trouble with to deal with all of the trauma, if you will. So, you know, got to take into account where you live in the United States, prevailing customs and oppression and power and control. And on a good day, most people don't feel good enough. And on the worst day, we know what that's like. It's just, you know, people can't get a leg up. So,
well, I bet. And so, obviously, your own background helped you to decide, I'm going to work in this population. I'm going to do my best to provide the most comprehensive of services.
Right.
And so, it's just a little bit of your story as to how you were able to buy a clinic that morphed into obviously intensive treatment and, you know, and hospitalization.
Sure. Well, you know, it really, this is a second career in life. This wasn't my first career. My first career was, I got my undergraduate in business administration because, you know, that's really what my parents had outlined for me. It wasn't that that's what I necessarily wanted to do, but I was one of the first persons in our family to really go to college. And, you know, we grew up poor in Kentucky and that type of thing. And I have a younger brother who's learning disabled. So the impetus of any kind of big thing was put into my lap. Well, growing up in Kentucky, I knew I didn't want to stay there. I didn't feel safe a good portion of the time. I could never really be my true self. There were glimpses of it, but, you know, it certainly wasn't going to happen there that I could, you know, integrate all these parts of myself. And so I moved to Chicago and got a job working in the entertainment industry in a company that was owned record labels, and their parent company was Seagram's. Well, Seagram's, of course, is alcohol, and working in the entertainment industry, I had open access to just about every drug that could be possible. And what I didn't really have a full grasp on at the time was, you know, I had really sort of, my alcoholism had kind of taken root. And, but the funny thing was, I didn't really like the sick part of being under the influence. I didn't, you know, it wasn't that I didn't like the feeling. I just didn't like vomiting and all that. So I ended up switching to harder and harder drugs. And so, you know, I started drinking when I was 10. I didn't get sober till I was 35. So I've been sober 13 years now. And I ended up really the drug that really sunk its claws into me was crystal meth. And so I was, you know, I would have used anything you put in front of me, but crystal meth was my thing. And, you know, it is a drug that for me made me feel like I was Superman. All the things that had been said and done throughout my growing up years really, you know, get pushed out of my periphery. And I thought that I was invincible on that thing. And I ended up having a really bad accident, and I ended up shattering both of my arms, both my elbows, broke my knees, four ribs, and a bunch of bones in my face. And so I ended up going into the hospital, and, you know, really, I had to learn how to walk again. And so, of course, it gives you a lot of pause for thought when you're in a hospital bed for, oh, I don't know, I think I was there a good month or month and a half. And so came out and didn't know what to do, and had a good friend who said, listen, I think I know of a place you can go. I had no money. I was homeless. He said, but listen, I think you can do it. And I, by, you know, some higher powers paved the way for me. And they said, as long as you can ask for help while you're here, because I couldn't operate my arms. My arms were in cast shoulder blade to fingertips. As long as you can ask for help, we'll take you in. And I thought, well, it's got to be better than what I'm doing. So I ended up going in and completed an inpatient program, a detox program, and really for the first time started to feel good about myself for who I was. And then, you know, started going to meetings and got a good therapist and started this path. And then it quickly occurred to me that I needed to get into a career where I felt like I was giving back, just like somebody had given to me. And I went back to school and got my, you know, my master's and all these good things and started to work in social work and was doing really well. Well, then my mother passed away, and she had been, you know, witness to all of my, you know, the wreckage. And but she had been a real support and had come around on her own attitudes about what it meant to be a gay male. And we had to do some real soul searching, she and I did, and needed to make our peace with all of it. And when she passed away, she left, you know, a good amount of money. And my husband and I both kind of scratched our heads and thought, well, what are we going to do with this? And, you know, higher power again came around, and the place that we own now, I knew the gentleman had owned it, and he was selling the business. And so we took a leap of faith 4 years ago and bought the business. And we knew that even in the city the size of Chicago, that there was a lot of room to do better work for the community. And we knew that the need was there for therapeutic groups and clinicians, you know, for when the client walks in the door, they don't have to figure out if they feel safe or not. They don't have to worry about, is this person going to understand me, or are they going to shame me or ridicule me? So, you know, we started with even just throwing out furniture, and we brought in all new clinical staff, and it's just has sort of blossomed from there. And, you know, I do a fair amount of traveling now, speaking at conferences and working with clinicians on cultural humility and power and oppression dynamics and how all of these addictions sort of intersect with each other. And it's just really has been mind-blowing, you know, kind of what gets put in front of my lap to do. And, you know, I rarely say no to anything because there's so much work that needs to be done in the community. I think, you know, we're just scratching the tip of the iceberg. So that's the long story of how I got to own this operation. And I work with the most amazing group of clinicians, and I've connected with the most amazing group of clinicians and got to be on radio shows and television. I'm going to South Korea in July to talk at the World Social Work Conference on these very topics. So, you know, just things just keep unfolding, and I'm just grateful that, you know, that sober today and where it's led.
Well, and you have, you know, you obviously exhibit the very thing that can happen to a lot of people. They have to hit rock bottom to have the wake-up call, and then what do? They learn recovery, take their lives to the, you know, that next level, the 12th step.
Right.
And achieve amazing things.
Yeah.
So congratulations on turning your life around, because you could have sat in that hospital room, got more and more depressed, and drank yourself and done meth yourself into oblivion. And you chose not to do that.
Left to my own devices, that's what would have happened. And it's not lost on me that, you know, this accident, I was on a fourth floor balcony and I was using IV and I blacked out and I fell over the side of this balcony all the way to concrete. And,
wow.
You know, even in the shock of all of that, it was the oddest thing. Because even as I'm laying on the ground and all of these things are happening and ambulances are coming and all this, you know, there was almost this relief feeling that came up over me. And I was, you know, I was in and out of conscious. I was shocked. I was in shock. But I can remember just even being in the hospital immediately afterwards and in immense pain and just going, you know, this was the wake up call. And if you can't do something with this story and turn it around, you know, the next step is not going to be the ability to come back from it. I mean, that's how ill I felt I was.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my higher power works in mysterious ways, and everything from I had drugs in my backpack and the ER doc found them and said, listen, I will get rid of these right now if you make a commitment to get treatment. And I said, you tell me what to do and I'll do it. And I did exactly what he asked me to do. And I've not looked back, knock on wood. But that's why I think what makes people good clinicians, when we're impacted by, when we have our own story of impact. Now, our own clients may not know that. They may not know what got us there. But I think it's when us as clinicians have that or similar experiences and can say, yes, I see you, I know you. The stories are different, but the core issues are the same. I think that's what makes, you know, a pretty powerful clinician and, you know, not just learning it out of a textbook, but really walking it.
Absolutely. And were you married at the time?
I was not married at the time. I wasn't even sure that marriage was even going to be in my lifetime, you know, because I'm almost 50. I'll be 50 and I don't know, within the year. And so growing up, I didn't know that gay people would be accepted, let alone, you know, be able to get married. And so it didn't really occur to me. And I didn't meet my husband until after I got sober. And it was probably, a year and a half later before we even went on our kind of a first date, because my sponsor said, don't date in the first year. So I didn't, because I thought, well, my own device has got me to this place. So you tell me what to do. And, you know, we met and we've got a super healthy relationship and he understands addiction. He's actually our CEO. We own the company together. So I do the clinical end of things and supervise the clinical team. And he does all the marketing and the insurance and the business end of things. And we've somehow got this little team going and, you know, we've got a 19-year-old daughter as well, who's been a part of it. And she, you know, she works kind of behind the scenes, but we've got a little family thing happening. And the number of people we've been able to work with has been remarkable.
Well, absolutely. And I was asking you if you were married at the time, because I was thinking to myself how your life had changed. And, you know, here you were homeless, your mother dies, she leaves you money, and you pay that forward to the greatest of your ability. Yeah. And really, your entire life has transformed in all sorts of different ways.
Yeah, it has. It just is. And I say this to clients I work with, you know, if you just put one foot in forward of the other, things happen that you have no idea it's going to be on my radar or on your radar. And it's, you know, each day of sobriety is kind of a miracle. And, you know, I had been to prison twice and I was homeless. And I mean, it just had really taken a turn. And I think, again, if I had been in the steering wheel in 2003, I would have probably died at some point. My veins were collapsed and just in bad shape. But, you know, I think that fall, I'm grateful for the fall today, you know, the literal and physical fall. I'm super grateful for it, because without that, this would not be occurring today. And so, you know, it's grateful every day that I get to do this.
Well, and I want to tell everybody, right now I'm talking to Jeffrey Zacharias. Is that how you say your last name?
Zacharias.
And
yeah,
you can actually check out, he has two websites. It's first of all, it's his own personal, www.jeffzacharias.com. Or
correct,
you can go to his website, www.new-hope-recovery.com, and take a look at the treatment that he has to offer. Now, I want to ask you a little bit about what someone could expect if they live in the Chicago area and they want to look into getting some intensive treatment. What's the process, Jeff?
Okay, so we do both partial hospitalization, which really doesn't, you know, the word hospital is in that description, but it really just means all day programming. So it'd be like a 8 to 4 or something along those lines. And then if a person's not appropriate for that level of care, if they need more of an intensive outpatient, we do both morning and we do both evening. And so morning is 5 days a week, evening is 4 days a week. It's the same treatment. It's just that we do our family program a little bit differently for our daytime clients. And we do family of choice or family of blood, because so many of our LGBT clients don't often have a blood relative who either, you know, doesn't want to be involved in their treatment because they, you know, the LGBT issue is there, or, you know, they're detaching because of the addiction or whatever it might be. But so they can bring their sponsor, they can have their best friend, they can, it just really needs to be somebody who's supportive of them and calls them family. So we do family of choice, family of blood, and then we do outpatient, which then drops to 2 days a week. And then we have a really extensive alumni aftercare group, which is you either come in the evening on Mondays or during the day on Tuesdays. And, you know, that group is the group that for the new persons coming in, they get them connected to a recovering community. We do a lot of fundraising. We just participate. We sponsor the Chicago Roundup, which is just a big weekend of recovery event. And so we just did a bowling fundraiser for that this weekend. And our program is very holistic, and so what used to be at this location was just sort of cut and dry addiction treatment, more with a, you know, sort of a only 12-step focus. We've broadened that, and we do, it's real holistic. So for us, we do, if your client wants to do 12-step, that's great. Many of our LGBT clients sort of bristle at 12-step language, and we understand why, because of spiritual abuse and some of the other things they may have experienced in family of origin. So if that's the case, then, you know, we have in Chicago, we have what's called Quad A, which is Atheists and Agnostics of Alcoholics Anonymous. They can go to that, and sometimes that language is a little better. We offer smart recovery. You know, we can have clients go to depression, bipolar support alliances, any number of things to at least get them connected to some larger community. And then, you know, we encourage them to go to CMA or SLA or SCA or NA or any variety of things, whatever it takes to get that connection going. And again, our, you know, our families are with us for a while. So when we do our aftercare for our clients, we also have aftercare for our families. So they're all connected throughout the start of treatment all the way through, and they can be with us as long as they want to be connected. We do some scholarshiping of clients, and my frame of reference, I don't want clients to pay me back, because if a client's, you know, if money is the biggest issue between them being well and them, you know, potentially dying in their disease, what we do is we ask the clients to pay it forward. And I don't need to see how it is that you paid it for, but we're setting a strong expectation and intention that you're going to take this thing and run with it. And the next person who comes up behind you, however you can pay it forward, if that means taking them to meetings or buying them a dinner or whatever it might be, we just want to set the intention for, you know, doing the next right thing. So, and then we do have insurance that we take and self-pay and whatnot, but our overarching goal is legitimately to get people well or to believe that they can do better and that they're worthwhile and they're valuable. And so if they want to get involved with us, all they have to do is pick up the phone. We have clinicians that answer our phones 24 hours a day. So if they call and they get the answering service, all they have to do is say, I'm a client, I'd like to come to New Hope. They patch them through to one of the therapists that's on call, whether that's myself or a variety of others. And we can spend time with them on the phone. We can help direct them to, you know, if they need to go to detox, we'll find them spots in detox. And if we're not the right fit for them, we'll help find the right fit. And, you know, we're planning the entire time for, like on day one, do you have a therapist? Do you have a primary care physician? Do you have an infectious disease doctor? Do you have an OBGYN, whatever it might be? And we're getting those lined up on day one. So when the end of that level of care comes, that they're ready to go into that next sort of phase. I think we do an amazing job, and we're not just only LGBT focused. We will service anyone. We just happen to have this strong, strong component that our groups aren't large. We only do 6 to 8 people at a time, because we don't want big personalities to come up front and then the smaller ones to not get their needs met. So 6 to 8 with master's level or above clinicians who are really seasoned in addiction, sexual compulsivity, you know, any eating disorders, you name it, we can work with it. So.
Well, that sounds like an amazing program.
Yeah.
And so what would you like our listening audience to know as they listen to your services, as they listen to your story, especially if they're in the Chicago area? I'm assuming that most people that come to you are local. I mean, they live somewhere in Illinois.
Right. Well, we get Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, and Wisconsin. Chicago's kind of, it is, because Chicago's an interesting transient community. I mean, a lot of people come to Chicago to live. I don't know that they stay a super long length of time, because sometimes the winters are too brutal, and so people just kind of stay for a while and then they move on, or family has done the same. So what we know is that we get a lot of clients from the Midwest because family is close, or, you know, there's some great sober living facilities in Chicago we can get them hooked into. So, don't let distance or money or Chicago or any number of things scare you off. It never hurts to make a call, right? And as I said, we can take calls 24 hours a day. There's no charge. You know, we generally like to have people come in to do an assessment. So if they're interested, we invite them in. They can tour the facilities. They can meet the staff. That way they have a sense of what's going to happen and they get the feel of it. And that's, you know, there's no strings, no nothing with that. It's just come on in, meet the staff. Let's talk about your case, find out what you need. And then if we need to refer out, we will. If we don't, we'll service them and we'll get them started. So don't feel like you can't call, and know that when you call us, there will be no judgment, no shame, no criticism, no sort of, you know, power dynamics gone awry. It really is a group of people whose mission is to help people, particularly those who all of these addictions are fused together, because we know it's not just alcohol and we know it's not just a drug. These are entire systems that have learned to work together, and, you know, like meth and sex and some of the love addictions and like opiates or alcohol, some of the more depressant chemicals. So we know those things are there, and we really treat, not concurrently, we treat it all at one time. So we're not going to come in, you're not going to work on a week on meth and then a week on sex, and then, you know, it's attacking the ground as soon as you come in, after we establish safety, and we really work to build this strong therapeutic alliance and get you hooked up with doctors and psychiatrists and therapists and, you know, get your families involved, whoever that might be. So the whole system is ready to go. And we really do have a great understanding very quickly of what the stories are with these different sort of process addictions. So again, you know, we know a lot of times with our meth users or our stimulant users, there's a strong sexual component and a porn component. We know those things, not 100% of the time are true, but pretty often. With our more relationship-oriented or love-addicted more type of clients, we know that there's a lot of opiate use, benzo use, alcohol use, some of those more soothing, warmer type chemicals and how they interplay with each other. We know with our younger people, you know, there's a lot of synthetic chemicals, the spices and the K2s and some of these other things. With our older individuals, we have, you know, a lot of alcohol usage. And then there's all these really interesting fusions of processes and behaviors in there. And it's just like an onion, pulling it apart and seeing, you know, seeing what we can get to. And I don't know. I mean, it's often with our, another example, like with our meth stimulant users, it's really about intensity as opposed to intimacy. And a lot of our guys think that because they're having lots of sex, that means they're being intimate, and it's not necessarily the case. So we really look at why you're looking for intensity. What is it about intensity that you're, you know, it's taken on this flavor? And so there's just this constant evolution and puzzling and trying to figure out the who's, what's, and why's and heal the person so they're, you know, to live these fully formed lives that they're intended to live.
Well, absolutely. And you know what is so impressive as far as I'm concerned is that there was so much shame about drug and alcohol abuse. And then obviously, mm-hmm. as you indicated, there can be a lot of shame, blame, and pain if somebody is not heterosexual. And so you combine
yeah.
those two, and they can really fuse into a lot of self-loathing. And,
they do.
You know, your program, and obviously your clinicians, sound like they're so compassionate, caring. They understand the delicate balance of what do you need to do to make your life different.
Yeah.
Got expertise in, you know, how to get somebody off of drugs and then
yeah.
how to help rebuild their personhood. And so it sounds like a phenomenal program. I don't know of another program in the Midwest that is that sensitive and sounds like that compassionate, especially with that pay it forward mentality.
Yeah, I don't, there's not a lot. I mean, there's Pride does great work, and that's in Minneapolis. And then as you get outside of our little part of the world, there really isn't a whole lot. And that's why I think our clients do really well. Now, you know, it's very hard to come up with success rates because that's subjective and objective. But our clients really do report longer term recovery. And, you know, we do know that like with meth, clients with meth problems, the success rates, I think I read a statistic not too long ago that said that 7 out of 100 individuals that have a meth addiction will make it sober more than a year.
Wow.
So, you know, the stats are low. Then you add what we know is the sexual compulsivity. Then we know that oftentimes there is an increased rate of HIV contraction because, you know, not using protection and then that altered state and not really thinking as clearly. So there are all of these issues that come in the door. And, you know, we really do get it. It's not, you know, it's being able to say to the client pretty directly on day one, listen, here's what I think is going on. And I'm wondering if you could let me know about this. And so, you know, they're often amazed that you understand porn addiction or the fusion of sex and meth or love and opiates. And, you know, and they just automatically get that sense of you get me. And one of the other things we do is even like in our offices, we have literature out. We have just little markers in the room, like on my bulletin board, there's a rainbow ribbon on my bulletin board. And so that's already a visual indicator of safety for our LGBT clients because they know at that point that you understand what that means. So it's everything from visual cues to being able to give voice to what's going on to saying, we get it. We're here to help you reduce the shame. And then, you know, begin to get them connected. We do a lot of Brené Brown work as well. We have a therapist of ours that's a friend of mine that comes in and does the Daring Way curriculum once a week. And then we do, of course, DBT and some other things. So, you know, we really try to connect quick and fast and to give them those feelings of intimacy and connection rather than intensity and chaos and drugs and sex and all the other complications.
Yeah, great point. So, excellent point. Well, it has been fascinating, Jeff. And again,
thank you.
You can tell that you've really got a compassion for people, and you're obviously willing to do what it takes to make people's lives different. Again, anybody who's interested, they can either go to www.new-hope-recovery.com or Jeff's own personal website, which is www.jeffzachariasi.com. I wish you continued success. You're doing amazing work. And any way I can help you, let me know.
Well, thank you. It is really, it's an honor to have done this, and I'm really grateful for you, Carol, and the work you do in giving me the platform to talk about this and to be an ally to the community. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. And all the best to your husband, too.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Have a good one. Give us a call if you need anything, anybody, okay? All right, take care.
Absolutely. All right, well, that was, as we were speaking, that was Jeff Zacharias, and although I think he might have said it's Jeff Zacharias, and, you know, obviously he has turned his life around. I hope that is proof to you that you can do amazing things, too, when you find recovery. And, you know, with sex addiction, there are multiple addictions, so it's not typically just one addiction, and Jeff's here to prove it. Okay, well, we will see you next week, and look forward to many, many, many more shows to help you, whether you're the sex addict, whether you're the spouse, whether you're a family member, or whether you're just looking into, do you have a problem? Again, you can email me at carolthecoach@aol.com or go to my website, Sex Help with Carol the Coach. I will see you next week, and as I say at the end of every show, one of you at all times, fearlessly have the courage to be yourself. Have a great day.